Welcome to the Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore. It is Sunday, October the 3rd, 2021. On this edition of the Politocrat, part two, the taking of a woman's right to choose, the taking of a woman's autonomy, a human rights violation. This is part two of a hearing that took place on Thursday, September 30th, 2021. More audio clips from that hearing coming up right after this. Welcome back. I am going to play these two pieces of Q&A back to back without any interruption. This is involving the next 9.5 minutes or so, 10 minutes or so, involves Dr. Skop, Ingrid Skop, the pro-life obstetrician in San Antonio, Texas, who has spent almost 30 years being an OBGYN and also practicing what I call some very dangerous kinds of things. I mean, eugenics, which is racist as hell. We know that that movement is toxic and dangerous and racist. She, to me, is a pro-eugenicist. She's a eugenicist as far as I'm concerned. And some of the things she says later on, I don't know if I'm even going to bother playing them because it's just more toxicity and I don't know. It's bad enough I'm playing these next two clips back to back. But I assure you that the two congressmen who, and believe me, you're going to hear from some congresswomen, some more congresswomen, because I mean, I wanted to try to keep this as much female as possible, you know, because I quite frankly, I think that on this podcast, you need to hear more female voices. And so, I have to do better, much better at that because, hey, there you go. I just think that I do. Personally, I think I'm going to do better. It's far from where I want it to be. And so I will, you know, make sure that those changes happen and not just talk about them, but do them. Because I think it's important to not just talk, but do. And it's much more important to do, right? Just do something, right? Than just talk about what you're going to do. That's what politicians do, don't they? Talk about what they're going to do. And then half of it never gets done, does it now? I know. You've got a base to talk to. But on the more serious note, next two Q&As, you're going to hear first from Jamie Raskin, the Democratic congressman out of, I think, Ohio. Congressman Raskin had some tragedy in his own life, in his own family over the last 12 months. I think it was just back last November or October, or January might have been of this year when he suffered the loss of his son. I think his son had either been involved in an accident or ended his own life. It was a very sad thing. So I think it was actually, I think, back in January of this year. So, or whenever it might have been. So forgive me, I don't remember. The Congressman Raskin here with Dr. Ingrid Skop. And then the next clip after that you're going to hear is Congressman Ro Khanna out of California, right here, not far, actually. Well, actually, his district is about 30, 40 miles south of San Francisco, so it's not exactly close by, but anyway, it's in the Bay Area, so the peninsula. So the peninsula here in Northern California. So you're going to hear from Ro Khanna, the progressive Democrat, and you're going to hear Dr. Skop as well in that Q&A. So here are both of them back to back, first with Congressman Jamie Raskin and Dr. Ingrid Skop.
And Mr. Raskin is recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Women in the United States have had a constitutional right to an abortion since 1973. And that's not an argument. That's an old-fashioned thing called a fact. Since the middle of the 20th century, American women have been free to make their own decisions with respect to abortion. And this is as it should be, for every woman's situation is unique, as we've heard from women witnesses on both sides of the aisle today. Some women are 32 and have become pregnant by choice and are hoping to have a baby. Others are 19 and have become pregnant by rape, abuse, or incest and would never consent to bear their rapist or abuser's child. Some have the private resources and personal health necessary to raise many children. Others are impoverished, ill, depressed, in emotional or mental crisis, and could not seriously contemplate it. The point is, every woman's situation is completely different and deeply personal. So the real question before us in America today is, who is going to decide for the women of America? Is it the women of America? Or is it state legislators, 69% of whom are men? That's the question. Who is going to make these most private and intimate decisions? I know that every member of the committee on the other side opposes Roe versus Wade and the constitutional right to privacy. But I wonder if any of them are willing to actually defend the details of the new Texas law. It not only makes it unlawful for a woman to have an abortion after 6 weeks, when most women don't even know they're pregnant, it deputizes every person in the United States, from all 50 states, including rapists and sexual harassers and insurrectionists and murderers. Everyone, including snooping and spiteful neighbors, feuding relatives, to go out and sue the doctors, the nurses, the medical personnel, and family members who help, who dare to help their daughter or niece or sister or mother through a health crisis. And they can sue them for $10,000 under Texas state law today. That's America in the 21st century today, with the constitutional right to privacy under attack. This is our future and our present in the nightmare Orwellian world that the GOP wants to deliver to us. But our friends don't want to speak about the specifics. So I want to ask specifically every single witness here, do you think the law should be changed in America so women and girls who are raped can be forced to bear their rapist child as under the Texas law? Do you think the law should be changed so women and girls who are raped can be forced by the state to bear their rapist child as under the Texas law? And I will begin with Ms. Steinem, if she's still out there. Okay, then Ms. Aziz, if I come to you. Just this yes or no, if you can. Should the law be changed so that women and girls who are raped can be forced to bear their rapist child?
As a survivor, I can't fathom the thought of having to carry my rapist's child, and no one should have to do that.
So your answer is no, it should not be changed. Okay. Dr. Moyadeh?
No.
Thank you very much. Dr. Scrop?
No, I don't want to see the law changed. I want to see people's hearts and minds changed about this unborn human.
Okay. So I take it your position then is Roe versus Wade has it right. The woman has a constitutional right to privacy, but we should engage in the old-fashioned American arts of persuasion, of trying to convince people to our point of view about an intensely private decision like this.
Thank you. That is why I'm here today.
Thank you very much. Ms. Murray, Professor Murray, what about you?
No.
Okay, and Ms. Ross, what about you? I don't know if she's
still there. The answer is obvious. No, because my son had a complicated life getting to know his pedophile father. And the fact that I had to deal with this man re-raping me emotionally just to raise my child, that's an obvious no.
Well, Ms. Ross, I want to thank you especially for your testimony. I want to thank all the witnesses, but you have really made vivid for the United States what we're talking about here, which is every woman's situation is different. Every family situation is different. And the Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey made this a personal decision. And the doctrine has changed from one of the trimester framework. By the way, everyone saying you can have an abortion up to 9 months, that's deranged. That's got nothing to do with the law in the United States under Roe versus Wade or Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which draws the line at fetal viability. But I just want to say every witness here on both sides now seems to agree that the Texas law is deeply flawed, if not completely unconstitutional, in impinging on the woman's right to choose and compelling her to go ahead and
bear her rapist or her abuser or her assailant's child against her will. And that's an outrage and that's a scandal. That's totalitarian. Let's go back to the constitutional right to privacy and let's have the discussion. Let people can try to engage with each other and move each other. And I thank Dr. Scott for that point. But let's not trample on the constitutional rights of the people. I yield back to you, Madam Chair.
I'm not sure. Are you asking me if I financially support or if I just support?
I mean, are you sympathetic to what
Well,
these
I think there are differences.
Yes or no, Dr. Scott? Are you sympathetic to? I mean, I assume. That
well, there are differences of opinions within the pro-life community, just as I'm sure there are within the pro-choice community. I think they did a heroic thing. And again, I'm proud that Texas is the first state that's been able
okay.
to
here's my question
enforce
for you,
a restriction.
And I hope you will condemn this because former Texas Solicitor General Jonathan Mitchell, who has filed an amicus brief on behalf of this group, Texas Right to Life, in the Dobbs case, the group that you describe as heroic. And the brief argues that, quote, homosexual behavior and same-sex marriage are, quote, court-invented rights. These rights, like the right to abortion for Roe, are judicial concoctions, and there is no source of law that can be invoked to salvage their existence. The amicus brief is asking the court to overturn Lawrence v. Texas and Obergefell, meaning basically they want to criminalize homosexual behavior again, and they want to take away same-sex marriage. Can you today unequivocally denounce that amicus brief and say how embarrassed you are given your beliefs that they would put something like that to the Supreme Court?
I really have no opinion on that statement. I don't think it relates to the issue of abortion.
Well, of course it does. They're putting an amicus brief in the name of Texas Right to Life, and part of their argument for overturning Roe versus Wade is linked to issues of LGBTQI equality. Does that concern you that groups in the name of defending SBA are trying to overturn Obergefell and Lawrence?
I really have no opinion on that. I wonder. Could I clarify what Congresswoman Fox said that you mentioned about Margaret Sanger?
I can do that on someone else's time.
Okay.
I really want to know if you don't find any embarrassment in the fact that you have briefs written in part of the pro-life movement that are basically advocating for the criminalization of homosexuality. Are you even aware of that, that these briefs are being written seeking that in the court in the case law?
I don't see how that pertains. I would imagine there are briefs written in support of Roe that may contain facts that you might find potentially controversial.
This is central to the legal
Madam Chair,
argument.
His time's expired. Perhaps Representative Anna could suggest having a hearing on homosexuality after your hearings on white supremacy and
Madam Chair, I have a point of parliamentary inquiry.
The gentlelady's recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, with respect to the gentleman from Louisiana, my understanding of the way we run this committee is that it is the chair that decides when an individual's time has expired. And the gentleman should have his mic muted and is out of order when chiming in to tell you when someone's time has expired.
Yes, you're right.
Isn't that correct?
You are correct.
Excuse me, the floor is mine at the moment. Forgive me if I made reference to the wrong person, but whoever has been calling out is out of order, Madam Chair, and it is you that controls the time and tells members when their time has expired.
Well, we're all trying to stick. We are all trying to stick to the 5-minute rule.
Okay, I would just ask that members refrain, or you make sure members refrain from telling you when that is, and that we follow procedure so that you can manage the time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back. And I do want to remind you that, dear listener, that this may be a distressing episode, because these are very intimate, deeply personal stories, and some of the things described you may find to be graphic, and so it might cause some discomfort. But I'll tell you that none of this is as uncomfortable for you as it is for those women that you are hearing from. And I know that sounds very paternalistic and whatever else it might sound like. I am simply saying that that's, in my view, that is exactly the case. I haven't experienced any of the events that you are hearing about. And perhaps maybe you, dear listener, have not. But there are people listening who I am fairly, if I may be so presumptuous to say, confident, who may have had this happen in their lives and may know someone who has, if it has not happened to them. So as I promised, I want to play these two clips now of two congresswomen, because I do want this to be, and I tried hard with these clips to get the clips where it was female members of Congress who, and not male ones, although you have heard a slew of those. You've heard at least, forgive me, at least three. And I want to really put this where this should be, with members of Congress who are women asking questions or making comments and statements about a deeply, deeply personal issue that is an issue that we all have to be involved in terms of opening our mouths and raising our voices and getting involved in preserving rights of autonomy. That's what this is. This is the right of autonomy. Autonomy. And this is supposed to be, a country where there is freedom of movement, freedom of choice. But that's not really true. It's not been true for black people. You can forget it. It's never been true for us. Freedom of choice, we can't move before a police officer shoots and kills one of us. It's never been true for us, right? It's not been true for native indigenous peoples. It's not been true for a whole lot of people, brown people. So we don't have freedom of movement in this country. We barely have freedom of choice. And you're seeing now this draconian push by these Republicans. And they're trying to have every state in this union be Handmaid's Tale. We have to raise our voices against this. You're going to hear from two congresswomen right now, back to back. In the case of the second one, I'll mention their names in a moment, but in the case of the second congresswoman, I just missed the beginning of what she had to say. And you will hear the passion. I missed a little bit of it, but you will hear from her. And you will hear from both of these congresswomen right now. AOC is first up. Right after that, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib. First, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Even be held in a legislative body. 6 weeks pregnant is two weeks late for one's period. When you are raped, you don't always know what happened to you. You are shocked, and I speak about this as a survivor. You are in so much shock. And by the way, people who commit abuse and victims and survivors of sexual assault are overwhelmingly assaulted by someone they know. And this myth that it's some person lurking on a street or in a parking lot waiting to sexually assault you, that myth only benefits the abusers in power that want you to think that that's how it happens. It's your friend. It's a boyfriend. It's a boss. It's a legislator. You are in so much shock at what happened to you, sometimes it takes years to realize what actually went on. So this idea that victims know in the 2 weeks that they might be late for their period, I'm a buck 15, I'm 115 pounds. You look at me funny, I'm 2 weeks late for my period. And you're supposed to expect me to know that I'm pregnant? Or the stress of a sexual assault? That makes you 2 weeks late for your period, whether you're pregnant or not. Unbelievable, unbelievable that the Republican side would call a witness so irresponsible and hurtful to survivors across this country. Honestly, deserve your constituents an apology. Now, Professor Ross, yes or no, is it a common tactic for an abuser to sabotage their partner's birth control? Are you on?
Turn on your mic.
Yes, they keep silencing my mic. I'm not. Yes, I hear it all the time. I've heard from women, particularly when they're in the control or power of their abuser. Now, they do it all the time. And we've seen people who are forced to continue pregnancy, and we've seen people who are forced and coerced into having abortion. And that's why it has to be the woman's choice and not the people with power over her.
Thank you, Professor. And so, as you said, it is a very common tactic for an abuser to sabotage a partner's birth control, a victim's birth control. Now, in your advocacy experience, would you say that abusers often do this to intentionally try to get their partners pregnant without sometimes their knowledge?
Yes, that happened. Now, in my case, I don't think my abuser, my rapist, married cousin wanted me to be pregnant because he ran as soon as he found out that my father knew. But I do hear women's stories all the time. And there's so many circumstances. You can't come up with one story that fits all those different circumstances.
Thank you, Professor. And as we, you know, can see that abusers will sabotage their partner's birth control in an effort to exert power and control over them. Dr. Moyetti, when we see that the tactics of abusers on a personal level, the attempt to control and sabotage a victim's reproductive care and control over themselves, then becomes mass adopted by overwhelmingly, frankly, cisgender male state legislatures. How do you see a connection between these abuse dynamics in person and how they inform a culture in which they could be affirmed or in which these laws could potentially help or assist abusers in this dynamic?
Yeah, so unfortunately, our country is actually founded on reproductive control and coercion of enslaved Africans and of indigenous people. So this is actually a historical tactic in our country and a method of upholding white supremacy. So that has not changed and continues today.
Thank you very much, Doctor. And my time has expired. I yield back to the
chair. Thank
you. How the wraparound services that she could actually provide for her family because she made a choice. But we abandon those mothers every corner. We vilify and dehumanize. I've watched them force mothers to do drug testing before they could even get any assistance. When are we gonna actually call this out for what it is? No, this is about controlling women in our country, period. Stop pretending it's anything but. You know, what's so distressful about all of this is the fact that it's not just Texas, Chairwoman, you know this. This is literally opening the floodgates to the possibility that we are actually going to see our country punish and criminalize abortion, criminalize women making a very difficult decision. I want to know, you know, Dr. Scott, like, honestly, what are you doing about infant mortality rate among Black children? Have you testified in a committee about it?
Thank you for your question. I'm very interested in the topic. I have applied to be a member of the Texas Maternal Morbidity and Mortality Committee 3 times. I have not been accepted. Mm-hmm. I suspect it may be because of my stance on life. Mm-hmm. But I'm terribly concerned by the lack of support that so many of those women have.
Yeah, well, the same people that voted for the bill that you are championing today are people that would actually leave them completely homeless and with no safeguards at all. I want you to believe me when I say that to you, because Black Lives Matter should be very much at the forefront in every policy that we ever do in this country. It can't just be you carrying a sign or being on a commission. It's actually standing up and saying what we see. Because I want to tell you something. You know, over 40% of the deaths of COVID in my state are my Black neighbors, even though they make up less than 14% of the total population of Michigan, because of environmental racism, because they don't have access to health care, and you're all punishing Planned Parenthood, which is literally sometimes the only option that they have, because people are investing and saying, this is how we can get access health care. I'm really just incredibly frustrated of the gaslighting, the misleading, and trying to say you're speaking on behalf of my Black neighbors. You're not. You're not. And so I'm going to leave with Ms. Ross. I saw your face and the pain in your face, and I just have to tell you, you know, as you were listening to them, I could see you had a lot to say. And I'm going to leave you with the last minute to tell me how you felt when you heard them talk about, oh, this is killing Black folks. Tell them what is really killing Black folks in this country. Go ahead and tell them the truth.
Well, I'm tired of white saviors saying that Black women aren't smart enough to make our own decisions about our lives. That's what I'm tired of. That is the ultimate in racism. To accuse us of being less smart, less human, and less caring about our children than you do. When your actions speak louder than your mealy words, because you vote against children having lunches, getting good schools, getting rid of guns so that they can survive. You vote against everything about our children once they're here, and yet you want to say that you're a better savior of Black children than we are? Get over yourself. If this white saviorism does not convince us that you have our interest at heart.
I hope you heard her, because, you know, a mentor of mine told me when I got here, some people are never going to hear or see you the same way I do, Rashida. But I hope you saw Ms. Ross and you felt what she's saying, because it is the truth. You want to save lives? Start investing in tearing down structural racism in our country.
Next, I want to go to Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I think that the previous two congresswomen spoke loudly and clearly, and so really, I'm trying not to editorialize, but I know I failed miserably. I know I have. Yeah, that male urge to just always chime in on everything. I at least have a degree of self-awareness, right? Right? I mean, there's the man's... Listen, there are these elements of us as males. That's not true of every single human male out here. But there are some things. One of them, I mean, there's a lot of things, but one, here's two of them. One, the urge for a male, some males, to chime in on every single thing, particularly if a woman is speaking, right? And interrupt, right? That is something very male that happens. And another one, as I said, the urge to chime in at every moment. And the other one, another one is, you know, God, I can't believe I forgot it from... The urge to mansplain. I've got to mansplain to you, you know. Two women, two females. I don't like to use that word, females. I just think the language of it is not... Obviously, people who are female. I've got no problem saying the word. I just think that it sometimes gets used in it. Anyway, I'm putting myself in, digging myself a ditch, aren't I? And I'm sorry. Let's say that there are two women speaking. And some man has to come in and interrupt, particularly on social media. I've actually caught myself doing this a bit too. And I've had to stop myself. I know I've done it a few times, but I have tried to improve. And I'm still working on that. And I think I'm a whole lot better than I used to be at this. But you know, the urge to chime in and add your opinion to something. Not mansplain, because I don't think I do that. But then I am not the best judge of that, right? But there is this thing, this mansplain. Although I think I sometimes chime in. I think I'm definitely guilty of that. But the mansplaining thing, that's something that there are a number of men out there that do. And the men that do that, in my view, are threatened. They feel threatened. Like something's going to happen to their manhood if the two women who are speaking about something that may involve a man, and that's the, I'm not talking the Bechdel test in film. And if you don't know what the Bechdel test is, please look that up for those of you who don't know. But on social media, if there are two women or more, maybe an all-female forum, and some man comes in, whether he's a bot, a troll, or just some, you know, whatever, and has to say something, your manhood is challenged if you, oh my God, I can't allow these women to speak without chiming in because my manhood gets hurt in all its feelings if I don't say something. It's just rubbish, but that's what happens. It's just really creepy. And it's these particular men I'm speaking of are insecure and toxic and need to just go and get some help with all of that. But again, the problem is in a society like this that reinforces all this stuff, where are they going to get the help from? They're not going to get the help from the society, because society is the very thing that's doing the same things. It's a toxically masculine society. Anyway, I don't want to go off on what the men are doing or not doing. I really want to keep this on women and on a woman's right to choose and on a woman's autonomy and on the issue of autonomy, because that's where this is. And it affects each and every one of us. It truly does. So I want to continue with the Congresswomen. You've heard from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Congresswoman Cortez, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib. You just heard from them. And now you're going to be hearing from Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And I think she'll also be asking some questions in this first clip. And then in the clip after that, you're going to be hearing from, I believe her name is Wanda Ross. She is a woman, I believe in Michigan, who is an activist for women. She has been doing the great work and the hard work for such a long time. She herself, you may have remembered earlier in this episode, I played audio of her telling her own story about a rapist child. I mean, she carried to term the child of a rapist. And so you're going to be hearing from her again here. You've heard from her, I think, a couple of times, making the point very clear indeed. So first clip, the Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Second clip, you're going to hear from Wanda Ross, and you'll hear a little bit of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the Congresswoman out of Florida, as well toward the end. So roll the clips. They're going to be uninterrupted. They're less than 10 minutes for combined for these. So please listen to these, because I think these are very important.
Of the attacker. Forcing women to give birth from a pregnancy conceived from rape is forcing women to repeatedly be re-victimized by their rapist. And that is outrageous and unacceptable. Now, soon after the Supreme Court allowed Texas's 6-week abortion ban to take effect, anti-choice lawmakers in several states announced similar legislative abortion bans, including my own state of Florida. These grotesque Texas and Florida bills in particular pose some of the greatest threats to abortion access in U.S. history. One of the most alarming aspects of these draconian and blatantly unconstitutional bills is that they allow private citizens from anywhere to become bounty hunters to enforce the 6-week abortion ban. This is the snitch society and big brother vigilantism of Maduro's Venezuela and Castro's Cuba that my constituents have fled. Anyone, from local anti-abortion protesters to out-of-state lobbying groups, can sue any individual helping patients access abortion. And that could include a clinic receptionist, or even someone who drives a patient to an appointment, including family members, friends, or even Uber or Lyft drivers. Ms. Murray, as a legal expert, Can you tell us what this means for people accessing abortion in Texas? And what would it mean for individuals in Florida if that copycat bill was signed into law? And in your answer, can you provide a little more detail about the nefarious nature of this bounty system enforcement strategy? Do you believe the goal was really to have private citizens actually file lawsuits or just create an intimidation culture of fear that will prevent women from receiving abortion care?
Thank you for the question. I'm delighted to answer it and to set the record straight on SB 8, Texas's flagrantly unconstitutional 6-week ban on abortion. The law was purposely crafted to avoid judicial review. Typically, when abortion bans are put into law, they are immediately enjoined because they violate the Constitution, and federal courts will stop them from going into effect while their constitutionality is being litigated. In order to avoid that, Jonathan Mitchell, who is the architect of SB 8 and also the author of the bill previously referenced that cites Lawrence versus Texas and Obergefell versus Hodges as the next precedents to be overruled after Roe. He crafted this law for the purpose of taking the state out of the enforcement mechanism and delegating enforcement to private individuals. The purpose of this is twofold. One, to dismantle any system of support that a pregnant person might rely upon in seeking abortion care. And two, to ensure that a federal court cannot come and stop this law from going into effect. That produces the procedural irregularities that the Supreme Court cited in allowing this ban to go into effect. And it is the reason why today there are millions of people of reproductive age in Texas who are without the same constitutional rights that the rest of us enjoy.
The next thing you will hear after the break is the voice of Congresswoman Katie Porter out of California, the Democratic Congresswoman. You will be hearing her ask a question of Dr. Skop, Dr. Ingrid Skop. You have to listen to what transpires here. And then you'll be hearing from Professor Melissa Murray as well in the clip. But you have to listen to what transpires through the first part or the first portion of what you're going to be hearing in that questioning Congresswoman Katie Porter does with Dr. Ingrid Skop. And that's coming up right after this.
Has become an acceptable form of racism in the United States today. You wrote clearly, abortion has disproportionately affected the Black community, leading to a decrease in their population numbers, as well as many adverse consequences to women and children. Many of the pathologies, your word, affecting the Black community can be at least partially attributed to the breakdown in families and the absence of paternal involvement facilitated by abortion. Mental health complications in Black women leading to deaths of despair can be caused by abortion. Could you explain to me what your expertise and familiarity is with Black families?
Well, I have a niece and a nephew that are both Black.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Dr. Skop. Turning now to Professor Murray, how would you respond to this argument?
So thank you so much for the question. The purported links between abortion and the eugenics movement is a subject of my own scholarship. I recently published a paper in the Harvard Law Review outlining the ways in which this narrative of abortion as eugenics is being used to advance race-based grounds for overruling Roe versus Wade. And the increased interest in this narrative can be traced to Justice Clarence Thomas's 2019 concurrence in Box versus Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky. There, Justice Thomas attempted to graft abortion to the history of the eugenics movement in the United States. Unfortunately, the history upon which he relied to do so was woefully incomplete. Justice Thomas was correct to note that in the 1920s and 1930s, the United States was in the grips of eugenics fervor and its concomitant interests in racial purity and white supremacy. However, in advancing those interests in racial purity, the eugenicists did not rely on abortion. Rather, their efforts were channeled into bans on interracial marriage, immigration laws that kept certain ethnic minorities out of this country, and most importantly for our purposes, forcible and coercive sterilization of those with so-called weak or deleterious genes. These sterilization laws were later repurposed and redirected in the 1960s toward poor women who were receiving public assistance. So So this is all to say that sterilization rather than abortion was the eugenicists' preferred means of reproductive control. And to the extent that abortion figured into this eugenic fervor at all, it was in the effort to compel native-born white women to reproduce in greater numbers. In the period following the Civil War, there was considerable anxiety about the changing demographic character of this country. White middle-class women were using contraception and abortion to limit their families to manageable sizes, while immigrant women were having babies in record numbers. Fearing the replacement of native-born whites by immigrants, policymakers sought to reverse the trend among white women by enacting criminal bans on abortion throughout this country. And then finally, I will just note that some of the members of this committee are among the 14 House Republicans who voted against making Juneteenth a federal holiday. When you fail to take even this modest step to acknowledge the Black experience in this country, it is very difficult to take seriously your claims that your support of flagrantly unconstitutional abortion restrictions are animated by concern for Black women and our children.
So that was Representative Katie Porter. Oh man, that clip speaks for itself as well. Congresswoman out of California, out of this state here, and she's in Southern California, and oh dear, that was so good. Sure, I mean, this is how you have to deal with people like, anyway, that particular doctor, Dr. Scott, my goodness me, it's terrifying to have people like this in healthcare and in medicine, I mean, these are the kinds of people that you've got. Whew, my goodness me. It sends chills down my spine. And goodness gracious, you know? Anyway. Dear, oh dear. So that was Congresswoman Katie Porter. And you heard from Professor Dr. Melissa Murray, professor of law at New York University Law School. And also you heard from Dr. Ingrid Skop as well. My goodness me. So there you go with that. And then I want to close out, I think, with one other statement. I think it comes from Wanda Ross again, because, again, I think that she... as someone that we need to be listening to, all of us, indeed every one of the women you've heard from on this episode, you've heard, you know, you've heard from all of them. I think that pretty much all of them make very compelling cases. All of them do except one, you know, because that one particular woman who is the doctor out of San Antonio, Texas, Dr. Scott, is arguing for some very dangerous things, and dangerous things that will... make sure that women don't have any rights at all. Now, really, this is not me going off half-cocked. This is very serious. This is if the kind of view that Dr. Scott has prevails in this country, and quite frankly, it's becoming prevailing wisdom, and I put the word wisdom in quotes, because it's in legislatures right now, Republican legislatures, this kind of view is being promulgated into laws. Hence Texas, SB 8. Hence a movement in Florida to get the bill in. There's a bill in Florida on this too. There's bills. Listen, at least 26 of the state legislatures in this country are Republican. I think it's maybe 30. We can't have that. I mean, that means you and I have to vote. That means it's the importance of us dealing with these midterms for 2022 as if they're starting now, because they really are. This is why I keep saying that we must behave now as if the midterms have already begun, because they essentially have. And we've got no time to be sitting around. Not that you are sitting around, dear listener. I'm saying collectively. I mean, the Republicans are throwing everything in your face, telling you this is what we're going to do, and here's how we're doing it, right in front of you. And what are we doing? And I know many of us are doing things. I'm just talking collectively. Where are we? You know? And the Democratic Party, the DNC, has to get involved in this. we can fight on more than one front. And we don't have to always be getting fundraising emails. Every time I look around in my email box, there's a fundraising email from the DNC. Or from President Biden. Or from Vice President Harris. But yet, what there isn't is a Voting Rights Act passed in the Senate. What there isn't is a For the People Act passed in the Senate. What there isn't is the end of a filibuster. What there isn't is a woman's right to choose intact in every state. But meanwhile, can you spare us some dimes, brother, for our DNC? This is, again, this is part of the hearing that took place just 2 days ago on the 30th September of 2021, a very important hearing on abortion rights in the House of Representatives. And I dare say most people missed it, didn't hear anything about it, did not see any clips of it. You can watch the entire 5+ hour hearing, if you so desire, on C-SPAN at cspan.org. You can go search for it. It's from September the 30th, 2021. It's a hearing on abortion rights, and you should be able to find that in that entire hearing. But I wanted to just play it to get the full context. But I just wanted to play a number of clips from it that I think you need to hear, because these are very, very, I mean, it was a very important hearing. I think some of it, I decided not to play all the eugenicist garbage that was coming out of Dr. Scop and coming out of some of those Republicans who were questioning her, who really were making statements and really kind of not even really questioning her at all. You know, this is how it goes on aisle one and aisle two. But anyway, the bottom line is that this hearing was important. And now you're going to be hearing from Wanda Ross and from, I believe it is, Congresswoman Brenda Lawrence before I bid you adieu for this particular episode. Take it away, Wanda Ross.
I've written testimony because I feel the need to speak from my heart, because my story disproves many of the theories that abortion opponents like to talk about. In 1968, I was pregnant in Texas at 14 years old through incest from a married cousin who was 27 years old, who instead of babysitting me, thought it was a good idea to get me drunk so he could have sex with me. In 1968, I didn't have any options. My only choice was whether to have that baby and give him up for adoption. But I found that once I had my child, I couldn't go through with the adoption, because it's not as easy as people try to say it is. So for the next 30 years, I ended up co-parenting with my rapist. And although I fiercely loved my son, I hated his circumstances. And that complicated what my child should have received, unconditional love from his mother. Because as he grew up and grew to resemble his father, it was always there what had happened to me. I was lucky enough 2 years later to receive a full scholarship to Howard University to major in chemistry and physics. And when I became pregnant while at Howard University, I was also lucky enough to be able to access a legal and safe abortion at Washington Hospital Center. And that abortion kept me from becoming a teen mother with three children, because I was pregnant with twins at the age of 16. So I didn't have any choice whether to have sex, whether to have a child. And it was so hard to raise that child born of rape and incest. And so I really don't think it should be more difficult 53 years later for a child in Texas than it was for me in 1968. I really don't think so. And now I'm wondering, is it a matter of people that don't know our stories, or is it that they don't care? Because 50 years of telling our stories doesn't seem to change the hard heart of people who haven't been through what we've been through. And I'm wondering, what does it take? So in 1994, because of what I'd been through, I was one of 12 black women who created the theory of reproductive justice, because we needed more than what either the pro-choice or the pro-life movement offered us, which is the right to have the children that we want to have, the right not to have the children that we don't want to have, but most importantly, the right to raise those children in safe and healthy environment, because nobody focuses as much as we need on what happens to the children once they're born. And so we have used this framework. We have popularized it around the country. I am so honored and privileged to be able to tell my story, but I'm wondering if merely telling my story and all of our stories is enough. Because if you don't care, I don't know what it takes to reach your heart. But I can tell you, that theory of rape and incest, just have the baby and give them up for adoption and, you know, accept that your life will be forever changed. If you have not lived life, then I wonder if you really know what you're talking about. And I was very glad that I had both my son, but I also had a choice 2 years later whether or not I would become a mother of three children and sabotage the rest of my life, but mostly not be able to provide for the child I already had, because he became the most important thing to me, and I celebrate his life by the fact that I had choices. So thank y'all for listening to me. I want y'all to talk about what it really like for people who don't have choices, who live in Texas, who shouldn't have to go through what I went through in San Antonio.
I first have to remark on something that I couldn't believe I heard out of somebody's mouth, and that is that they want 18 million more black people in America when we got a few hundred thousand at the border that they won't let in. But that's just me that notices the hypocrisy and the ridiculousness of trying to make race-based arguments out of the people, out of the mouths of people who only enact race-based policies against black people. So I'll just let that go. I think that it's very important for us to understand the intersection of racial justice policies and gender justice policies and reproductive justice policies, because you don't understand why these bans on abortion are not about having more black and brown babies born. They want more white babies to be born, because if they can restrict abortion to black and brown women, they'd send limousines to take us to the clinic. I know that for a fact. And whether or not you believe me, look at the disparate treatment that our children get once they're born, whether they go through a school-to-prison pipeline or have a property tax-funded school system where, by definition, the poor neighborhoods have poor schools, the way we want to address gun violence or lack of health care or environmental problems and lack of clean drinking water. I mean, when you put it all together, you can't separate this fight for abortion rights from the fight for voting rights, for civil rights, for environmental justice. And one thing that infuriates me is they think that we're too simplistic, as if we are some enslaved people who can't do an analysis of what they're really saying when they talk out of both sides of their mouths. There should be masks, by the way, because like you say, they won't wear a mask to protect public health, but they want to be in my bedroom and in my body telling me what to do with it, with that most private decision about whether to commit my life to another person's life. But I do want to raise one point, and that is talk about how many people think that black women are threatened by Planned Parenthood. I've never worked for Planned Parenthood. I'm not an employee, but I'm going to speak up on behalf of black women who are constantly told that we're not smart enough to determine for our lives the decisions we need to make. And I really think these white saviors need to stop acting like racists, because if you don't want to be called a racist, stop mouthing those racist talking points against black women, because we see you for what you're doing, not for the mealy words you're saying. You don't care about our lives. You don't care about our children. And we don't care to have you denigrating a Planned Parenthood, which does work to save our lives, because you think we don't see through your hypocrisy.
I do hope that you found the audio from this important hearing held just 2 days ago on Thursday, September 30th, to be of edification and something that we really must be aware of, because there are a lot of us who aren't aware of the ordeals and all of the terror that women go through when they are faced with choices like this and then faced with rapacious male legislators who want to block them from having their own freedom to choose something. Imagine if a man was told he couldn't do something, right? He couldn't, well, I mean, just use your imagination, right? I don't even have to, I mean, come on. Imagine you know, let's put it in a reproductive framework, right? Imagine a man being told you have no access to birth control. You have no access to that. If you have sex, you're going to have to reproduce. And you're going to have to be responsible for that child that comes from that, if a child does come from that. Because, of course, not every sexual encounter that, you know, it does not have birth control accompanying it. Goodness, that's an awkward statement. You know, not every unprotected sexual encounter results in pregnancy. But what if there was an edict tomorrow that said, and there never would be, that's why I'm saying what if, right? As long as you've got male legislators and a patriarchy controlling things, you're not going to have this. But let's just imagine for a moment, let's indulge in this. What if there was an edict, a national edict, throughout the United States and anywhere else for that matter, but here in the United States, that said, right then, every man who has sex has no access to birth control. No condoms, nothing. And you can't get vasectomies. And you're responsible for that child. If a child comes out of your sexual encounter, your sexual intercourse, you're responsible. Or even if the child doesn't come from that encounter, you have to pay the woman half of your wages for that encounter. I know, it's draconian, isn't it? I know, you think it couldn't happen, don't you? It's ridiculous, doesn't it sound? But think about what women are going through. And let me tell you something. Those scenarios I put up for the men, that is pretty much what is happening to women, with obvious variations. And it's happening on steroids. In Texas, the physician's got to give you the pill, the da-da-da-da-da-da. It's got to be so intrusive. You know, these Republicans who believe, oh, no, we don't want big government. And there's no bigger government than the government that's invading a woman's womb. I mean, that's as big a government as you could ask for. And yet these Republicans have no problem with that kind of big government. No problem at all. Bounty hunters chasing after women and chasing after people related to women who may have whispered in their ear once 10 years ago about some advice about abortion. Oh, we're going to come after you. So now you're encouraging more violence against women. Really great. In the name of what? Pro-life? Saving lives? You've got to be kidding me. The most violent people on the planet are the pro-life movement. These people are gangsters. They're thugs. They're worse than thugs. They are gangsters. Showing up and killing abortion clinic doctors like George Tiller. Get him in a church and kill him? Oh, great. I mean, you want to talk about the Antichrist. It's these freaking pro-lifers. the most violent ass people there are. Give me a break. Absolutely disgusting. But just imagine if a man's rights were restricted in this way. Just imagine that. I don't even want to go, well, if a man can get pregnant, imagine if he could. No, go to what is here now, what actually we know can happen, right? What if we had forced sterilizations of men? And that was mandatory across the country. And there was a clinic, one or two clinics in every state that said, no, we're gonna find a way for you not to have this happen. Everyone would be flocking to those clinics, every man, or many men. I just really want people to, especially men, to think about this. Well, I mean, think about it. The only form, what if the law was, the only form of birth control for a man is for him to get a vasectomy? Otherwise, when he has sex, there's no birth control at all, right? And if the woman gets pregnant, I mean, I can just fashion so many scenarios. Let's suppose that these legislatures made it really difficult for men. Suppose. A woman doesn't have to have birth control, and only men have to have birth control. And there are no condoms anywhere. We banned condoms. So the only form of birth control available is a forced sterilization or vasectomy. Then what? Then what? Perhaps these hypotheticals are careless and sloppy and unrealistic. But these are scenarios that women are actually in with obvious variations. And some people aren't blinking an eyelid. We have to be a nation that cares about people. Cares about a woman's choice, a person's choice, and cares about the person having the ability to make that choice. That's the important thing of all of this. Autonomy must be for all of us, or else it is for none of us. That is really where it's at. Thank you very much for listening to this edition of The Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore.